C.S. Lewis' wife died, and he kept a journal for a while after she died, and just a very honest recording of how he felt. And I'll share some of that with you in a minute. Meditations for the Terminally Ill and Their Families. This is available in the bookstore. This was written, each one is a little bit different because each one is written by someone who had a loved one dying of something or by a terminally ill person. Again, it's a very honest book. And I have one of the devotions in here is mine. This is available also in the bookstore, and it's Leo Bustad's daughter. This one doesn't deal particularly with grieving. It's called Dancing in Africa, Letters of Karen Ann Bustad. But it does have some very good things to say. For instance, at one point she experiences the death of a student, and she talks about that. I think you would appreciate that. And where's the lady? There you are. I told her. She had one she found in the library here she wants to tell you about. Well, she's obviously enjoyed it, so probably worth taking a look at. Okay, come on in. Come on in. No, we let men in. I just recommended your daughter's book, so it's up here in front. I think then let's get started. Let's roll the tape. What we're going to talk about today is grief, a personal response. Grief is something we all do. It happens to us. It's not anybody's private property. And we do it from the time we're little children on. And yet it's something we seem to have been taught to avoid. And so we almost have to be re-educated to let people know that it's all right to grieve. It's normal to grieve. It's something that's important for us. Grief by itself is rather neutral, but it can be a learning process. We can learn from the grief situations in our lives. I want to tell you a story about when I was a little girl. I was probably about 4 years old at the time, and I had a doll that I very much loved. It was a rag doll. And I said, it was my daughter. It was my little girl that I took to bed with me every time I went to bed, and I cared about very much. And then I had scarlet fever. And I think most of you, many of you at least here, are old enough to remember that years ago when you had scarlet fever, you were quarantined. And you had signs put up in your house and nobody could come in and out. And at least where I grew up, the story was everything you touched was contaminated. And therefore everything you touched had to be burned. And I slept with my doll. So when I was nearing the end of having scarlet fever, my mother politely told me that we would have to burn my doll. And I said, no, you could not do that because you don't burn people's children. And this was my daughter. And my mother informed me that this was a doll and not my daughter and would be burned in the furnace. And I remember carrying on about this a great deal and appealing to my dad, who I was sure would save me from this terrible fate of losing my doll. But my dad said, too, I'm sorry, the doll must be burned. So the doll was taken away from me and thrown into the furnace. And I remember going through a great deal of terrible feelings about that. Terrible feelings towards my parents, whom I no longer trusted, because they had done something this terrible to me. Terrible feelings about myself, because I had not been able to save the doll. To me, the doll was almost human, and I had not been able to preserve her or save her from the fire. I don't know what I thought about God at that point, but I do remember wondering whether dolls had souls, whether dolls went to heaven or hell, whether the fact that the doll was thrown into the furnace meant that the doll would suffer eternally in hell. And I had had no control over that. So it was a very traumatic thing for me. We sometimes, I think, overlook the grief of children because as adults, we feel we know so much more. I'm not sure, I don't remember, that my parents seemed to care very much about what I was going through, because after all, it was only a doll. As you grow up, you encounter other griefs, and you find yourself encountering some of the same feelings that you had when you were a child, and you can't quite do what you did as a child, or at least you think you can. You can't carry on the way you did then. A more recent grief was the death of my son, and I'll share that with you, some of my feelings about that. We were in the hospital. I had been called at home and told that there had been an accident, and my son was in the hospital, and we should come. I did not bother to wait for my husband, who was at church. The town was where he'd been taken down, where he was in the hospital, was probably about, a dozen miles from our house, and I was closer to it than the church, and I wasn't about to wait for my husband to come from there. So another son of mine and I drove as quickly as we could. We passed the accident, the scene of the accident, along the way. And when I saw the car, I remember thinking, that's not so bad, he'll be all right. That's not so bad. Which was one of my ways of reassuring myself. My husband stopped on the way down at the accident, and he knew more than I did about how bad it was. We stood in the hospital and we prayed for the life of my son. We prayed for healing for my son, but my son did not live. I like to think that our prayer for healing was answered. Healing being something different than what we were thinking about at the time. But I remember going home that night and just being in a state of, I did not cry. I had many things to do. I had four other children, to tell about this death, and I didn't know how I was going to do that. I had a lot of things that had to happen. I didn't have time for crying, and I didn't cry. Remember sitting on the couch that night, thinking life will never be the same for us again, which of course it isn't after a loved one dies. But it was a while before I could cry. Someone yelled at me and tell me, you should cry. You have to let your children see you cry. I thought, I can't cry. I'm not ready to cry. I'll cry when I'm ready to cry, which I did. The other children, our youngest was 11, and the oldest was 18. And Tom was, the son who died, was 17. We went through a lot of trauma as a family. That had a major effect on all of us. What were some of our thoughts and feelings at the time? Let me read some C.S. Lewis. I think some of what he says fit me. No one ever told me that grief felt so like fear. I'm not afraid, but the sensation is like being afraid. The same fluttering in the stomach, the same restlessness, the yawning. I keep on swallowing. At other times, it feels like being mildly drunk or concussed. There's a sort of invisible blanket between the world and me. I find it hard to take in what anyone says, or perhaps hard to want to take it in. It is so uninteresting. Yet I want the others to be about me. I dread the moments when the house is empty, if only they would talk to one another and not to me. Or this one. Meanwhile, where is God? This is one of the most disquieting symptoms. When you are happy, so happy that you have no sense of needing him, so happy that you are tempted to feel his claims upon you as an interruption, if you remember yourself and turn to him with gratitude and praise, you will be, or so it feels, welcomed with open arms. But go to him when your need is desperate, when all other help is vain. And what do you find? A door slammed in your face, and a sound of bolting and double bolting on the inside. After that, silence. You may as well turn away. The longer you wait, the more emphatic the silence will become. There are no lights in the windows. It might be an empty house. Was it ever inhabited? It seemed so once. And that seeming was as strong as this. What can this mean? Why is he so present a commander in our times of prosperity and so very absent a help in time of trouble? Not that I am, I think, in much danger of ceasing to believe in God. The real danger is of coming to believe such dreadful things about him. The conclusion I dread is not, so there's no God after all, but, so this is what God's really like. Deceive yourself no longer. Or this one. For me, at any rate, the program is plain. Remember, it's his wife he has lost. I will turn to her as often as possible in gladness. I will even salute her with a laugh. The less I mourn her, the nearer I seem to her. An admirable program. Unfortunately, it can't be carried out. Tonight, all the hells of young grief have opened again. The mad words, the bitter resentment, the fluttering in the stomach, the nightmare unreality, the wallowing tears. For in grief, nothing stays put. One keeps on emerging from a phase, but it always recurs, round and round, everything repeats. Am I going in circles, or dare I hope I am in a spiral? I remember I read this book not long after Tom died. I remember being so grateful for that part. I had read many things about the stages of grief, none of which seemed to be working for me. And it pleased me a great deal to find another person for whom it did not move in nice, neat little pattern. For this one, sorrow, however, turns out to be not a state, but a process. It needs not a map, but history. Or this part. Grief is like a long valley, a winding valley where any bend may reveal a totally new landscape. As I've already noted, not every bend does. Sometimes the surprise is the opposite one. You are presented with exactly the same sort of country you thought you had left behind miles ago. That is when you wonder whether the valley isn't a circular trench. But it isn't. There are partial recurrences, but the sequences don't repeat. You see that he begins to change as he moves along through the grief process, and some of the changes are very small and almost imperceptible, but they are there. Or this, can a mortal ask questions which God finds unanswerable? Quite easily, I should think. All nonsense questions are unanswerable. How many hours are there in a mile? Is yellow square or round? Probably half the questions we ask, half our great theological and metaphysical problems are like that. I think that's important because we ask so many questions in time of grief. I don't think we need to find answers to all our questions because some of the questions don't even make sense. Heaven will solve our problems, but not, I think, by showing us subtle reconciliations between all our apparently contradictory notions. The notions will all be knocked from under our feet. We shall see that there never was any problem. Well, those are just some of his thoughts. All of you, as you have gone through various grief processes, either as children or as adults, and we are constantly facing the death of the old and the new life of the new. I always tell people, when someone you love dies, there's a death for the survivor as well. We as survivors die too, because there's a part of us that cannot be reclaimed. And we are then in the business of also coming into a new life. But the new life very often doesn't begin in a very pleasant place. So it doesn't seem at all like new life to us, but it is. It's new life, and new life is always comes forth out of every death. Well, you've had feelings, you've had thoughts, and you've had ideas, and you may not have talked about those to anyone. I'd like you to feel free to talk about those today. And I think we do that best when we talk in small groups. Always we have this fear of judgment when there are 20 people listening to us. But sometimes, somehow or another, in a smaller group, maybe of 3 or 4, we're more open to say, this is what happened to me. You've had griefs in your life. You've had times of loss. Share some of those, whether they are childhood. I'm going to give you a piece of paper that talks about it. One of them talks about childhood griefs, the other talks about adult griefs. You can talk about either or both in your small groups. Doesn't matter. Gives you some guidelines to talk about. I'm going to read those under adult griefs. First, name the experience which caused you the grief. You don't have to go into great detail about it. Simply let us know what that was or what happened, enough so that people know what you're talking about. But then move on rather quickly to what was your response to the event or the experience? How did you act? What kind of feelings did you suppress or think you needed to suppress? What kind of feelings did people tell you to suppress? You know, the nice don't cry things. What kind of physical responses did you have? Because we have physical responses to our griefs, especially when we're trying not to show our emotions. And they can be some pretty mean ones, from stomach aches to even cancers that seem to develop rather quickly after the death of a loved one. What kind of thoughts and ideas did you have? What kind of thoughts did you have about God? I didn't bring it down. I have a book upstairs. I was a 7-year-old who said, see if I can remember this pretty well. He was talking to his grandmother, and he said, I had a terrible day today. Everything went wrong. Everything at school was bad. Everything on the playground was bad. And on the way home, I felt so bad, I was throwing stones. And I told God, I hope one hit him right in the heart. At least his expression as a 7-year-old was a lot more honest sometimes than our expressions as adults. We're unwilling to say some of the things we think nobody knows that we're feeling. Feel free to talk about those here. And you might talk about the help you wished for, or the help you asked for, or the help you were afraid to ask for, like the 3 o'clock in the morning bits for me when I didn't want to wake my husband because he had a busy day coming up, and I didn't want to wake my kids because they had to go to school. But I sure wanted to talk to somebody, and I didn't want to call my friends because, and sometimes I think, a terrible, terrible thing for it to be 3 o'clock in the morning because there's just nobody around to talk to. And then talk about what you think you have learned from your grief so far. Share those with each other. I'd like to suggest you move into groups of about 4, and as much as possible, stay away from people that you know really well or you were in a group with already and you've already heard their story. Because as we hear each other and as we hear new people, we learn from each other. We have some good opportunities to hear some things. And if you disagree with what the other person's saying, that's fine. You can tell them if you want to, if you think it's helpful. If it's not helpful, you don't need to tell them, but you can say what you think. Feel free to say what you think, okay?
Sure.
Glad you could come for a while. Here I stand with you.
Thank you.
two out of this group and in 1 year keep it down. And give more people time. Can we pull two people out of this group? We got husband and wife over here.
No, I.
Husband and wife, one piece.
Oh, okay. I see.
You do my, okay. They only have to have it together.
I'm not with somebody that I know.
All right, let's just start. Start one more new group.
Well, I think she wants to keep us small.
Yeah.
I think she wants.
Very small.
I wonder, oh, here. We're concerned about the questions under one and two. And, Does this bother you?
No,
not at all.
Well, there are many things that cause us grief. We're just going to tell about one.
Anything from your own life. Anything from your own life. It can be a childhood concern, or you could start with the adult concerns. We don't have that much time, so we can't do both of them anyway. So why don't you each share one?
Okay,
one thing.
My husband's death. And I can recall my feelings about it. He had been ill for 10 years. And it was not a big illness at the start, but it was kind of an insidious disease that kind of progressed and, you know, zapped him. And I remember thinking, I remember him saying he didn't realize that it took a person so long to die. And then I can, I recall that, it was to me after it was over, because he had suffered, so I had a feeling of relief and a release for him and for myself, I think. And I remember people saying, oh, they didn't know how I was going to cope, and I was in such a, well, I don't think I really knew anything for about 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure I didn't, because I had to, you have to make the arrangements for everything, and then even after that. But I made myself go out, it was unbelievable. I made myself go out of that house within 3 or 4 days, and people would say, well, why don't you come over and spend the night? And I never spent the night because I knew I would have to live in that house, and why prolong? And these are just some of my feelings. Now, pass on to somebody else. These are just, I haven't read through the rest of them.
Let's take a look down here.
Okay.
Do you recall any kind of emotions that you
want to
talk about?
Well, I know I was awfully emotional. Well, it seemed to me like I could just cry at the drop of a hat, because you see, he was a person that he didn't like anybody else to come in. And then from February to May, it then had turned from the red corpuscles to the white corpuscles, which then are cells rather, which was leukemia. So, and then you weaken, and so he had to be turned every half hour at night. Needless to say, became terribly thin. And so because you're up every half hour at night, I think you really don't get too much sleep. And so I was just absolutely dead tired, so if anybody said anything to me, I cried at the drop of a hat. I think because of the grief, but I think because I was tired, I was drained, and that sort of thing. But he did not like anybody to come in and care for him. Because if I had to go shopping, I would say, well, gee, the neighbors will come over, and while I go to the store, I'll be fine while you go to the store, And up until about the last 2 days, or 3 days.
Did you ask any God questions at any time during the illness?
Yes, uh-huh.
Do you remember what any of those were? Are you willing to share any of
them? I'd just kind of forgotten about it. Forgotten it now, I think. I used to think, I wondered why this was so slow. I think I thought about that. and then why it was just continually, you know, when you see somebody going downhill and you see it for that length of time, you know, I think that's really hard. And I used to think, oh, this is so hard on him. And I felt very badly about that. And then I used to think, well, I didn't really know how people that had no faith could ever go through this. And the same, I thought that same way when my mother died, which was the first death that I had experienced. I thought, oh, if people don't believe in God, how can they ever face these situations? So I think that was. And then, of course, afterward, I think I went through this. Why did this happen to me? I never blamed him, but it was, well, why did it have to be me? Because I wasn't, after all, I was only 60. And I thought, well, that's really not young, you know, but you plan to live your life with your husband, you know, so. And he had just been retired for 3 years. So. But I think I said many one-sentence prayers, one throughout it all, and you do get through it. You think you're not going to, but you do. And I'm sure the rest of you have had
too. You know, speaking of your husband, my mother, because I still have my husband and my family, so we haven't had any immediate death right in our family, but I remember especially when my mother died, because she died on Christmas Eve. 8 o'clock Christmas Eve, and every Christmas Eve we remember that. But she had cancer of the pancreas and was ill only about 3 months. But she was very, very ill and in so much pain that she just wanted to die, you know. So you just don't like to see them lay and suffer, you know. So.
What were some of your feelings while this was happening? You said you didn't want to see her suffer.
Mm-hmm. Well, you kind of wonder, why does it have to be? You know, why does it have to happen to someone that's been so good? That's about it.
Remember some feelings? Did you feel?
Well, I don't remember that so much. We lived, you know, quite a ways from her, so we were just home for a short time when it happened. But she was a Christian.
That comforted you.
Mm-hmm. So I guess that's about it. But you wonder at the time, you know, why it has to be. But of course,
did anybody
there are a lot of
say anything to you at the funeral or at any other time that you thought was helpful or that was not helpful?
Well, they were all very relieved, I think, to see that she didn't have to continue her suffering, you know. That's about the extent of, you know, people would say that, well, it's a good thing she didn't have to suffer any longer, you know, because, well, they knew that she wouldn't get well, you know, and you didn't like to have them lay and suffer. So I guess that was the comfort we had, that she was, you know, not suffering anymore, and that's about what they would say. Nobody made any other remark, you know, that, you know, it was all new that she was ready to die, and that was important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, mm-hmm. Somebody else?
Well, I told you about my mother dying when I was 5. And then my husband died 2 years ago, but he had a bad heart. And he lived longer than he thought he would. I'm an RN. And so I was really kind of relieved when he died. You know, he died suddenly. We were watching Mike Hammer. And of course, about 7:30, he gave a big sigh. I could tell, you know, just gave a big like that. And so I could tell he wasn't breathing. And of course, I lowered his chair and I got out the stethoscope and I was giving him resuscitation. And of course, I didn't even call the hospital because I didn't want to leave him. I blew into his mouth and then do the chest resuscitation. But then we got 911 the next week, but we didn't have 911. And so then I called the hospital. And of course, they sent out the ambulance, and three gals came there. They're trained anyway for this stuff, but they didn't even resume resuscitation because they, you know, he was dead already. So I didn't really feel, you know, like, why didn't this happen to me or anything, because I could tell that he was failing for at least the last 6 months. He'd go for a hike with the dog, and then he'd have to come home and catch his breath before he went over to the neighbors and shot the bull, as I say. And he knew, too, that he wouldn't have lived that long if he didn't have a nurse taking care of him. But anyway, then this last May 15th, my brother died suddenly, and he was trimming his apple tree in the backyard. He'd been fishing with his son and grandson on Minnesota Opener on the 13th and 14th of May. And then his youngest daughter called me and she said, "I have some bad news to tell you." And I said, she said, "Dad died today." And I thought, what? And then he'd fallen off the ladder and broke his neck. And nobody found him till 7 o'clock in the evening. And they'd seen him at, I guess, about 1:30 in the afternoon. And it was kind of, the peony bushes were around, so he was kind of concealed, really, in there. But the ladder was against the tree, securely, and one limb had been cut off. So they don't know if he had a busy spell or a blackout or something. He had trouble with one knee, and when he'd get up, he'd have to kind of, you know, and when he put it over the other one, I don't know, he was down on his knees, and his head was down like that, but they could tell right away when they found him that his neck was broken. And, of course, his neighbor, his good friend next door, found him at 7 o'clock in the evening, so he must have been there. We don't know how long he was there. So anyway, then, of course, his wife has Alzheimer's, and she's in the nursing home at Ada, Minnesota. That's where they lived. And, of course, the neighbor's wife told her that Cliff had died, and her eyes got real big, and she kind of tried to say something, but, you know. And so the kids had never had a death in their family, you know. They had 3 children, 1 boy and 2 girls, and so they were really kind of, you know, didn't know what.
Yeah.
And I know Cliff came over when we picked out the casket for Bill, my husband, and then we picked out a wooden, because he was a carpenter. And Cliff did a lot of carpentering too. He was a manager of the Ada Grain and Feed. He was an elevator operator, and his wife did all the bookwork, but she got that darn Alzheimer's. And so we picked out a wooden coffin. He said, "That's the one I'd pick out for me," he said. So I told his daughter that he'd said that, and he had a wooden coffin too. That's the most recent death. I think there's been 6 deaths in my family.
I'm curious, the death of your husband, did you ever have any guilt feelings about not being able to revive him?
No. When you're a nurse, you see these people, you know,
yes.
Dying, and it was probably easier for me than for some people.
Yes.
But he had a pacemaker put in 1981, and I don't think I felt that.
Do you remember any particular emotions you'd like to tell us about at that time?
Well, I went to the hospital, and then my neighbor drove me there in my car, and then I just waited then until the undertaker really pronounced him dead instead of the doctor. And then they got a hold of a pastor, and so I talked to him a while, but I guess all I could think about was calling, you know, all the relatives, because they're out of town. See, he was from Wisconsin, and he came up to Minnesota because he liked it there so well. And so his 2 daughters, I had to call, and his sister, and his brother, and many, you know, some other people too. So I guess I started calling right away, you know.
How about in the days and weeks that followed? Do you remember? Was it hard to learn how to live again?
Well, it was. It was. Of course, I was single for a long time, and mm-hmm. so I was quite independent. Mm-hmm. And even when I was, you know, married to him, but I took care of all the bookwork and wrote all the checks and that. And he always said he hoped he went before I did because he'd have to go in the nursing home if he was, you know, he'd have to go someplace that someone could prepare his meals and that kind of stuff. So it was just lonely, you know.
That's it. I was independent enough because I had worked too, and I'd always done all the things around home, and I had kept the house and all like that, and knew it. And my husband had taught me, well, I mean, as I said, he didn't fail until about the last two or three years when he had to have blood transfusions, but of course, he always knew that he was. So he taught me to mow the lawn and how to prune the trees and all this stuff. So I was all really, really pretty. And I can remember my little gal next door saying, oh, she said, I just can't believe you. She said, now, if this had happened to my mother, she said, I don't know what we would do. She said, we'd just have to take her at our house and because she'd never be able to cope. So she, and as I said, I had two young gals next to me, which was really nice because they were in their 30s and you know, and they had kids and would have me over. And I think, you know, I had a great support group. And I think that's
right, having
a lot of it.
Support group is mm-hmm. very helpful
for many friends.
Yeah, and then, mm-hmm. and I think that's a lot to that.
We need to get this lady here.
Yes. I lost my husband last October, and we were on an 8-month RV trip, and we were on our way home, and we were in Arkansas. We live in California, and we were really enjoying each other and being together and playing. We felt we'd really found the child within ourselves, which Scott has mentioned several times. And so I had just written a letter to our children. They want us home during the holidays, Thanksgiving and Christmas. And we talked it over and we decided that maybe after all these years, we needed to be alone at Thanksgiving or Christmas, or that they ought to be alone. and that if we weren't home for Thanksgiving and Christmas, we wanted them to understand it. And one time we were in Nova Scotia, and it was pouring down rain, and I said to Vern, I said, you know, I don't even know where we are, do you? I says, nobody knows where we are but God. So he had a heart attack during the night, and I was curled around him and did not know that it happened. He was just like this. And the next morning I got up and made coffee and juice, and then went back and wondered why he was sleeping so late, and he was cold. I had many mixed emotions. First of all, we were in my brother's town. We were in a park, but we were in my brother's town, Russellville, Arkansas. The other thing was we just had a family reunion of his family in Iowa, and there was only one person missing, and that was his brother. And the night before, his brother and wife had come down from northern Arkansas and had dinner with us, and we'd had a wonderful time together. So in a way, I was thankful for God, to God, that this thing had happened in my brother's town. I ran out of the motorhome and ran over the phone, and I didn't have any money with me, so I had to run back again and run over the phone. But anyway, to get to my feelings, they went back and forth. We have three children, and my son is 10 years older than the other two girls. And he was the hardest one to tell. I told him first. And he says, I'm going to come down there. And I said, no, I'm going to get to you. And so he says, what do you want me to do? And I said, call your sisters. And so that's what he did. And then my brother flew back with me. We just left the motorhome and the car there. And then my daughters were very helpful. My one daughter stayed, and she did all the things that she thought was right. She went to the closet and was cleaning out all his clothes, and she was going to take them with him or with her. And I said, you don't take those with you. You leave them right here. And when I'm ready to get rid of them, I'll get rid of them. And I said, some of those things I like to wear because I feel cuddled in his arms when I wear some of his clothes. Now, they thought that was not good. Then my son caught me talking to Vern. And he says, you got to get over that, Mom. I says, why? I says, why did he leave me? I got all these decisions to make, and I want to hear what he has to say. And then I'd get upset with God. God of my youth, why have you let this happen to my family at this time? You've always been with me, and now all at once, where are you? And then I'd go back to my children, and they'd be doing something else good for me that I didn't feel was good for me. And now, I am here in this class, I'm here in Holden, for other reasons than I have said. I don't know whether I've grieved. I don't know what it's supposed to do for me. I think I've grieved. I get along pretty good, but I haven't been home since the 8th of July. I've just been going. And I had an opportunity to come up here, and I've lived in the Northwest. And one daughter lives in the Northwest, up in Port Angeles, Washington. And she is a counselor of many things, and has many words of wisdom for me. And so I got to come up here as a guest with a group from Seattle, and then I decided to stay. I liked it so well, I really felt, maybe I can find out what God wants me to do with the rest of my life. I'm not doing anything now, I'm just playing and running around. And I enjoyed playing with my husband and just running around. And I sort of enjoy it now. But
could you explain what you mean by you're not doing anything?
I'm not needed by anybody. Even though my husband was together and we really did for each other, I really felt that he needed me. And my family tells me all the time that they need me. And that's another big decision within my mind. My son is married to a girl that has no family. And he is a family person, and he wants me to stay in King City. And I don't like King City. I like the Northwest much better. And so I really want to leave, but I know what his feelings are. He wants me to stay there. And Diane says, my oldest daughter says, well, you can't let Rick dictate your life. And I says, well, maybe if I leave, he and Monique and Becky will follow. Because he loves the Northwest too. And she says, yes, that's true. And then I say, well, Diane, you don't understand. You've got good in-laws, close around here, and relatives. And so does Judy down in Camarillo. They live in the same town with his in-laws. And I'm good friends with all the in-laws. They're just like my family. And I said, but Rick doesn't have anybody. Rick and Monique and Becky but me. And she says, Mother, who did you have when you were 30 years old? And we were in the service. We were in the Marine Corps for 23 years. And of course, we never had family around us. But I never felt alone. Maybe I shouldn't feel that way for him. But those are things that are going through my mind now.
There's no such thing as shouldn't feel that way, okay? Whatever you feel, that's how you feel.
Okay. Yeah.
It's okay, darling, if I dictate your behavior. It sounds to me like you're doing your grief work. I think those of you, maybe, by the way, you hear, what 2 years did you say?
No.
Last October.
Last October. Oh, my goodness. Mm-hmm. We've got lots of time to make all these choices and around to make them.
No, they say wait at least a year.
Saying, don't sell the house at least for 2 years because he said, you're young, you can take care of that house. Well, I find it's good, but it's been 6 years.
Yeah.
Well, see. If you sold it because that was your choice at the time.
I think that's another thing with me. We had no roots.
Well, because you left your career, and so you lived in your RV more or less.
Well, not only that, but being in Marine Corps for 23 years. Then he went to work for Sears. We moved. And so Camarillo, California, we were there for 14 years. That's the longest we've ever been any one place. But then we left there. And so I can go back to Port Angeles and have wonderful friends. I can go to Camarillo and have wonderful friends, but no real roots, you know. So it's easy for me to leave King City because we've only been there around 7 years. But my son has a store there. We had the store, Sears store. And now he's managing it. And so I don't have any responsibility there. And I don't have any roots. I have a nice little church, but I'm a dyed-in-the-wool Lutheran. And most of the members there are from a community church that went under, and none of them are tithe-full Lutherans, and it bothers me. they go to installation of a pastor in the church, and they says, "Why, that was just like going to high mass."
Okay. Would you at this time take just a minute here, and I'm going to give you another instruction, and then you can go on talking again. If you take a look at number 3, it says that often at the end of discussions, we draw conclusions or bring about closure. And those terms imply bringing something to an end or to a close. However, the griefs of our lives can keep on teaching us something as long as we live, including those childhood griefs of ours, if we will let them. So it's probably not the world's best idea to draw too many conclusions, but to allow ourselves to be a little bit open to what we can be learning from these various griefs in our lives. As you listen to each other today, you may have gained some new insights for yourself. If you have done that, would you, in the time remaining, tell each other what new insights you think you may have gain from today's session? That to say that it's a new insight is not to say that it is an eternal truth. You know, it could change again next week. But for now, it's something that seems a little bit helpful.